Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, March 5th. For the first time, a Trump appointee has been arrested in connection with the January 6th Capitol riot. We'll talk about that in a minute with Politico's congressional editor, Alana Shore. And breaking this morning and related, Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell has filed a lawsuit against Donald Trump himself in conjunction with January 6th. Also with Alana Shore, we'll talk about two potentially historic bills that passed the House this week, but that might go to the filibustering Senate to die. And speaking of filibusters, this wasn't technically one, lasting into the middle of the night. But before they got to this morning's official debate on the coronavirus relief bill in the Senate, Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin decided to make a show of his opposition to the bill by having the Senate clerks read out loud the entire 628-page thing. The New York Times notes as a point of reference that the sixth Harry Potter book clocked in at 652 pages, and many of you know how thick that was. By the way, that was Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, in case you were wondering. Imagine reading the whole Half-Blood Prince aloud without a break. The relief bill took 10 hours and 44 minutes at about the same length. Here's 44 seconds of what that was like.
Section 2705, funding for grants for healthcare providers to promote mental health among their health professional workforce. Section 2706, funding for community-based funding for local substance use disorder services. Section 2707, funding for community-based funding for local behavior health needs. Section 2708, funding for the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. Section 2709, funding for Project AWARE. Section 2710, funding for youth suicide prevention. Section 2711, funding for behavioral health workforce education and training. Section 2712, funding for pediatric mental health care access. Section 2713, funding for expansion grants for certified community.
And on it went. The reading ended at just after 2 in the morning, Washington time. With me now is Alana Shore, Politico's Congress editor. Thanks for coming on, Alana. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Did you stay up until 2 a.m. watching the Senate clerks on C-SPAN?
Oh, I did not. We'd all read the bill in advance. The poor clerks were in a bind, though.
The snippet that we played, I was listening to that list and thinking, that's a good thing. That one's a good thing. Oh, that one sounds helpful. What did Senator Johnson hope to gain by having it read cover to cover?
Well, Senator Johnson kind of just wants to be a bother. And that's where a lot of the Republicans are at right now. They object to this bill. They want it to, first of all, be smaller. Second of all, have a greater share of its money going towards actual vaccines as opposed to other indirect pandemic aid. And they've decided they're just going to make the entire process as painful for Democrats as possible, which included the Johnson gambit.
Yeah. And, you know, Harry Potter, the Half-Blood Prince, ends with Snape casting the killer curse on Dumbledore and revealing that he is the Half-Blood Prince, spoiler alert for a 2005 book. How does the relief bill end? Kidding.
Well, the relief bill is likely to end in a pretty dramatic late-night cliffhanger. Right now, we're expecting the wee hours of the morning, Brian, to be passage for this bill. And we are expecting it to pass, but there could be some really tough votes, specifically a vote to lower the boosted unemployment checks in this bill could end up passing, which would be unfortunate for Democrats.
Tonight, the middle of the night?
Yeah, we're expecting right now sometime after midnight and before sunrise.
The bill is very popular in the polls nationally. Is there any reason to believe it's unpopular in Ron Johnson's state of Wisconsin, hard hit by the virus economy like everyone else's?
Yeah, I mean, indeed, the White House says it doesn't matter if this bill gets any Republican votes because it has so many support levels from actual Republican voters out there, including in Wisconsin. But it's important to remember for Republican senators that they are looking at a 22 election where they see themselves back in the majority. So they just have an incentive to obstruct as much as possible at this point.
Right. Did I see that President Biden is still having to negotiate with Democrats in the Senate on the relief bill and is excluding at the last minute here a few million people making decent incomes from the direct checks?
Yes, that's accurate. He's slightly lowered the threshold at which those direct checks phase out. It used to be 80, and now it's a little lower than that, 80K a year in terms of the phase-out levels. That was part of some deal-making at the last minute with Joe Manchin and some other more centrist Senate Democrats whose vote the president really needs on this.
And Democrats can pass the bill without Republican support in the Senate because it's a budget item. Not so for some other things passed or about to be passed by the House. That would be historic if enacted into law. A political article cites bills on policing, guns, and voting rights. Would you tell us what's in the police reform bill that did pass the House on Wednesday?
Yeah, the police reform bill is pretty much the same bill that was passed last year by the Democratic House amid the nationwide protests following the killing of George Floyd. And, you know, it gets at things like no-knock warrants, things like chokeholds, basically tools that police have used and have been linked to episodes of unwarranted brutality against unarmed Black Americans. It also addresses, most significantly, qualified immunity. That was a huge sticking point with some of the House's centrists at first. Now, qualified immunity is a legal doctrine that essentially provides police officers a shield from legal liability if they commit misconduct on the job. That's a huge deal given all of these episodes of brutality, and the House bill would basically do away with that.
You quote Senator Cory Booker, who'll be on with us here next week, expressing some optimism about advancing policing reform through the Senate based on his conversations with some Republican senators. Can you do political analysis on what you think a compromise bill that gets the needed 10 Republican votes might look like compared to the House bill? Or does it look more to you that there's just no path to that in the Senate?
Look, you know, as a congressional editor, I've learned to be as cynical as possible about what can actually pass a 50-50 Senate, not because Democrats like Senator Booker aren't trying, but, you know, they're really in a bind here because groups like the NAACP, the Urban League, groups that rightly have a huge stake in ensuring better racial justice and application of law enforcement, like the House bill, and they don't see why they should have to compromise. But unfortunately, to get it through the Senate, big compromises will be necessary, particularly on that qualified immunity provision I discussed. So it's really the question here is if Senator Booker can sit down with his counterpart, Tim Scott, on the Republican side and get a bill that will pass the House, will the left even approve of it enough? Or will they say, don't force us to swallow these half measures and will nothing happen? That's really what's at stake. And as far as political analysis, you know, certainly Senator Booker is trying. And certainly Senator Schumer has said he will bring some version of the police bill up to a vote. The question is, what does that look like?
Yeah. And is the immunity provision the main sticking point? And for people who don't know, that would allow police officers to be sued as individuals for alleged misconduct, but only up to $25,000. As I understand it,
yes.
Personal liability. But the Politico article notes that the bill passed entirely along party lines in the House, which means more than 200 Republicans voted no, even though it contains mostly key provisions that both parties rallied behind after the police killing of George Floyd. So was there rationale for voting no entirely immunity for police officers as individuals?
That was the biggest sticking point. It wasn't the only one. I think, you know, Republicans want to be invited to the table, and with Democrats in full control of Washington, there's little incentive to do that. So even though, yes, it's true, some Republicans in the House who voted against this bill liked and rallied behind specific provisions of it, the overall politics of putting it all together and passing it was not something they could get behind.
And here is Speaker Pelosi this week on H.R. 1, the For the People Act, as they call it, on voting rights, which also passed the House this week.
We wave flags in honor of our democracy, that this legislation is there to protect the right to vote, to remove obstacles of participation. H.R. 1, For the People. For the People, the first 300 pages were written by John Lewis.
So what are the key provisions of H.R. 1 for the people, and why won't 10 Senate Republicans likely vote for this?
Well, H.R. 1 makes a lot of important changes to ballot access. It essentially expands access to the ballot and seeks to kind of break from where state houses have been at in terms of rolling things back. Now, some specific provisions, it creates money for drop boxes. It allows early voting and makes that a must-have. These are all what feels like pretty standard Democratic Party fare. But keep in mind that Republicans, as a party, have been, frankly, behind restrictions on ballot access. And some of them have been open about the need to do so in order to ensure the survival of the party. So this is kind of an existential matter for Republicans.
And here's a list of some of the Republican objections per a Mike Pence article, as summarized on National Review today, that it would compel states to count mail-in votes that arrive up to 10 days after Election Day, compel states to allow ballot harvesting, as they call it, compel states to ban voter ID laws, compel states to allow bureaucrats to redraw congressional districts, compel states to allow felons to vote, even though that means felons who've served their time in prison. Are all those things factual, at least, and then it's a matter of debating right or wrong? Can you fact check that list for us off the top of your head at all?
Well, to be clear, it's an overreading of certain provisions in the bill. You know, certainly there is debate over the redistricting components of this, and you actually saw one pretty powerful Democrat, Mississippi Representative Benny Thompson, vote against his own party's bill over the redistricting portion. And you know, the debate there that even alienated one major Democrat is whether states getting the opportunity to start their own commissions on redistricting essentially empowers leaders in southern states to restrict ballot access for people of color. So that's a big deal that you have Benny Thompson, a senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus, still not satisfied with this. Of course, the list that you just read off, Brian, is an overreading not just of the redistricting provision, but some other ones as well. That said, you know, this is going to come to the Senate, and we could see the exact same dynamic that we saw on policing reform, where people aim for a compromise, but what might be able to pass looks very different.
And I guess what ties all those things together is that Republicans would say elections are a state matter, and the federal government shouldn't be telling every state, because states do have different provisions at the moment on some of these things, on allowing felons after they've served their time to vote. Some states allow it, some states don't. Voter ID laws, some states have them, some states don't. Allowing mail-in votes to be counted up to 10 days after Election Day, if they're postmarked by Election Day, some states have it, some states don't. And the Republicans are objecting to federalizing all those things rather than leaving them up to the states, right?
Essentially, yes, that's a pretty good summary of where the partisan demarcation lines are here. But, you know, it's also important to note that, you know, the electoral landscape, as I mentioned, is unfriendly to Republicans seeking to expand access to the ballot. And that deals with, you know, debates we have over, you know, in urban areas, maybe there's one, two drop boxes, which, you know, advocates for expanding voting rights basically say this disenfranchises minorities. It in some cases benefits Republicans. So there's a real electoral politics shadow hanging over this entire discussion.
Right. And this is historic in America, but it's really come to a head after the attempt to cancel the election on January 6th and leading up to January 6th, that it's not in Republicans' interest for more Americans to vote. And so the laws, certainly in the South, but really all over, have been a struggle between more ballot access and less ballot access, and the Republicans hang it on ballot security. But I think a fair reading is that the real issue is just trying to keep fewer people from voting and keep more people from voting, keep it as fewer people voting, and the people who are most easily locked out tend to be Democrats, tend to be older, tend to be poorer, tend to be black and brown. And in those conditions that make voter ID a little more difficult, make restricted voting hours a little more difficult to work around in their jobs, all those things. But you know, Alana, is it a little rich that Republicans are objecting to Democrats trying to federalize state elections when most House Republicans just voted to reject the state-certified results that Biden beat Trump?
Well, there certainly is some situational irony there, I won't lie. But, you know, to be clear, what we're discussing about, you know, saying the quiet part out loud among Republicans, acknowledging that expanding ballot access could hurt their party, it's only a few of them that have sort of dipped a toe in that direction. To your point, Republicans tend to talk about H.R. 1 in the context of the classic states' rights, anti-federalist approach that conservatives tend to prefer, right? Like, this is not a matter that Washington should get involved in. So that's how most of them discuss it, as you note.
So here's a tweet. I'd like to know who are the 8 moderate Democrats who want a smaller COVID relief bill. Is that an accurate count? Are there 8 Democrats in the Senate who needed that smaller relief bill? And if so, do you know their names?
Yeah, I'm not sure where the 8 comes from. People might be counting up, you know, the names of Democrats who are attending meetings on this. And, you know, we will actually see later today roll call votes on things like decreasing the size of the boosted unemployment checks that will put some of these Democrats on record. But, you know, one who's been pretty open about it is Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia. He was in the lead on these discussions about trimming the phase out, as we discussed earlier, for the direct checks and trimming the size of the unemployment benefit. Other Democrats who've been part of these discussions, Angus King from Maine, who's an independent who caucuses with the Democrats. But as far as 8 specific ones, we don't really know yet.
Richard in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi. My question is, why don't the Democrats work hard to get a national day where everyone has off from work and everyone can go in to vote? And why don't Democrats work hard to get everyone have a national ID? I mean, if people don't want to worry about, like, election fraud, like, and Republicans, you know, want these things, like, let's give them that. But let's ask for these other things. Like, let's work hard to make sure everyone has time to go in and vote, and everyone who's a citizen has an ID to go in and vote. That's my question.
Interesting, Richard. And I think Alicia in Queens has a similar point. Let's see if it's exactly the same or a different wrinkle. Alicia, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. It's exactly the same point. And I'm as left as you can get. But I do see a value in a voter ID. Give everybody at 18 years old, every citizen at 18 years old, a voter ID. And when they're naturalized, give them a voter ID. Every 10 years, let them come back for a picture until they're maybe 70, 75 years old and they don't have to come back for a picture anymore. But, I mean, there are so many ways to compromise, right? I just don't understand why the Democrats don't just figure out a way to get what they need to get done with some of the things that the Republicans are asking for. I don't understand why they can't do that.
Alicia, thank you very much. Have you heard any Democrats talk about this or respond to this kind of idea to basically issue every American citizen who's over 18 a voter ID?
No. And the reason for that is just because, you know, it becomes a huge issue for low-income folks, you know, folks who just don't have the wherewithal to actually participate in that process. That's really more of a conservative cause because in practical application, ID requirements tend to just limit access. Simply put, like, people can't really keep track of that necessarily. It's a nice idea in theory as far as expansion, but in practice it just doesn't look like that. So no, that's not something Democrats really talk about that much.
So to wrap this up, Alana, is Biden still talking unity? Because unity is great in theory, but then when no Republicans vote for these bills that seem to have broad public support in the polls, the only way to get them through is by the Democrats hanging together and not trying for compromises that don't seem likely to come. So what's Biden saying now?
I think Joe Biden isn't changing his ways one bit just because no Republican is likely to actually come to the table and vote for this doesn't mean he's not going to try again, even on the minimum wage, as our White House reporters have already put up. He wants to talk with Republicans in the Senate in particular who are looking for an increase below 15. That's just Joe Biden style. And, you know, you could say he misjudged Republicans on things like his nominee who failed, but I don't think he's misjudging them overall. I think keeping the door open is probably politically smart for him.
Alana Shore, Politico's Congress editor. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.